atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot to discover. Jamie Metzl is going to be on today. Brand new book out. You know, he was at the State Department with Obama, as well as Bill Clinton. And he's one of the leading minds when it comes to AI. Always, always look forward to talking to him. And standing by is Governor Glenn Youngkin. And we have a big show coming your way, focusing a lot on what's happening in Virginia today. And before we get to the former governor of Virginia, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We will proceed in a manner consistent with our approach to these types of ethics matters, which is to always and at all times follow the facts and apply the relevant law without fear or favor.
And that means that Congresswoman, if we're to believe Akeem Jeffries, Cifras McCormick will be out today because she swindled about $5 million worth of COVID money. Ethics deficit. House expulsion aplenty. As both sides target the other, we could be looking at two more being kicked out, and about 20 more have sexual harassment investigations. Did you know that? I didn't.
Number two.
Even politics should have rules, and those rules should not allow any state to have these midterm redistrictings. It just leads to chaos.
That is Ari Fleischer weighing in on what's happening in Virginia today. The people decide if they would like to turn the purple state blue, redraw the lines that would deliver the House, perhaps for the Democrats. We'll look at the polls and the final pitches.
Number one.
One of the things no one seems to have thought of in this long shot hope for regime change is that by killing so many people, we have totally disrupted the hierarchy of decision making in Iran. You have more radical people coming to the fore. So what you have is an erratic U.S. side, an Israeli side that's essentially uninterested in peace, and an Iranian side that's more radical and divided. It's not clear who has the authority to make peace.
Maybe not more radical, but certainly more divided. A last time to talk. American delegation heads to Pakistan to engage Iran. If nothing is produced, it's back to the fight. And let's bring in Governor Glenn Youngkin on that. Governor, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Brian, great to be with you. Thanks for elevating the profile of this most important election today. And I'll just tell you, this is not about Republicans and Democrats. This is about Virginians standing up for what's right versus what's wrong in this unprecedented power grab, which has been orchestrated in an unconstitutional way. It's also illegal because they violated our state code. And finally, it's immoral. They're literally trying to disenfranchise millions of Virginians, and they've done it in the most deceptive way. People can't even understand what the ballot measure says. And so let me just be really clear. Vote no. Vote no to preserve the integrity of what is a fair map in Virginia drawn by an independent commission as a result of a constitutional amendment that we just passed 6 years ago. And this constitutional amendment mandates a nonpartisan independent commission to draw fair maps. That's what they did. Love these maps, Brian. I mean, listen, it's 6-5 Democrats to Republicans, but it's fair. And Virginia is a purple state, and we should not have this ridiculous mid-decade gerrymandering process that overturns the voice of the people. And that's why I've asked everyone, get out and vote today and make your voice heard before they silence you.
It looks like compared to 2025, the vote's a little bit off. There was 1.5 million early voters, 1.42 in 2025 for the governor's race and others. And this time there's only 1.37. Who does that bode better for, the yeses or the noes?
Well, I think turnout helps the no's because we end up, particularly in our rural communities, I'm going to call it the rest of Virginia as opposed to Northern Virginia. So Rova versus Nova. And we have seen larger turnouts in Rova, which I think reflects the no vote. And we have seen less turnout in Nova, which I think reflects the yes vote. But at the heart of it, it's a lot less predictable because I've heard from so many independents and a lot of Democrats that they are repulsed by this whole process because it violates the basic standards that we as Virginians try to hold. Listen, this nation was founded on principles that were really formed in this crucible of democracy that was Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe and Patrick Henry. And it's all about fair representation. and the voice of the people. And now you have this ridiculous process, which, as I said, overturns and overwhelmingly approved. Two-thirds of Virginians said, we want independent redistricting, no politics, no politicians. And this overturns something that was so strongly adopted by Virginians. And by the way, let me just be clear. It was the independent redistricting was supported by now Governor Abigail Spanberger. It was supported by Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. It was supported by Democrats. It was supported by Barack Obama and Eric Holder. And now they are all coming out and saying, no, 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 no. Forget what we said. We're going to redistrict Virginia in the most partisan way, and we're going to take what currently are viewed as the fairest maps in America, and they're going to turn them into the most gerrymandered maps in America.
And, Governor, you know what
it's
they say?
So fundamentally wrong, and this is why people have to get out and vote now.
I watched Eric Holder on Sunday, and he said, well, this is just temporary. We're just doing this one time to counter what's going on in Texas because they did redistrict there. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, what Eric Holder didn't tell you is that the second he got out of the Obama administration in 2017, he started the National Democrat Redistricting Committee to redistrict the country in favor of Democrats. And of course, their first big success in mid-decade redistricting was in New York. But, you know, at the end of the day, Brian, this is not about tits for tat. This is about what's right versus what's wrong. And again, the voice of Virginians was heard loud and clear. And I just think it's one of the reasons why Abigail Spanberger, the current governor, is currently rated as the most unpopular governor in Virginia modern history. And there was a poll out last week that suggests she may be the most unpopular governor in America. And the reason for that is she absolutely lied to Virginia. She stood on the campaign trail last year and said she had no interest in redistricting the Commonwealth of Virginia. And all of a sudden, you turn around, the first piece of legislation she signs is a bill to enable this. Virginians don't like to be lied to. It doesn't matter what party you're from. It doesn't matter where you live. Mm-hmm. When someone is dishonest, Virginians will hold them accountable. So I'm hopeful that notwithstanding there has been this ridiculous influx of capital from monies from California and New York into Virginia, and you see Hakeem Jeffries here spending $20-30 million because he so desperately wants to be speaker. The bottom line is I'm hoping that Virginians understand, first of all, the difference between a yes vote and a no vote, and as I said, it's been deceptive, and get out to the polls today, make your voice heard, and let's vote no, and let's reject partisan gerrymandering.
Governor, by the way, it must really bother you, too, that once again, George Soros involved. This Virginia's for Fair Elections, leading the push for the referendum. The group has received millions in funding from networks linked to George Soros. Again, this guy.
Yeah, and of course, what the Washington Post has said is that this is the most brazenly dishonest campaign from the yes vote. Brazenly dishonest from the Washington Post. I mean, listen, these aren't folks that usually stand up for the conservative side of things. But in the end of the day, they actually have therefore said the no vote is the right vote. And when you see so much money flowing in from outside interests that have no interest in Virginia, they of course want congressmen and women who will vote like Californians and New Yorkers. We don't want that in Virginia. We actually want congressional representation that is local, so that people know the issues in their districts and represent the people, as opposed to being bought and sold by George Soros and friends from out of state.
So I want you to hear what Andy Linsky said of the Wall Street Journal, cut 31.
On Tuesday, I'm really going to be looking for the rural vote here, and I think that can tell you a lot about Trump's standing. I mean, this is really being set up as a test on Trump and a vote, a referendum on his leadership. And so the rural areas of the state, which really will be impacted the most because they are the ones that are suddenly going to have representation in Washington that comes from the, core liberal parts of the state.
So do you agree with that? Because the president usually dominates with the farmers.
Well, first of all, this is a referendum on where you live and do you want fair representation? And what I have heard from voters all over the Commonwealth, but as I said, particularly those in the rest of Virginia, is that they view this as incredibly unfair. It's illegal. And therefore, I'm seeing so many no signs across the Commonwealth of Virginia. And right. that has been such a key part of this. Listen, the president and Speaker Johnson did a teletown hall last night, a telerally last night to get the vote out. We have seen strong turnout from our rural counties relative particularly to last November's gubernatorial election. And, you know, listen, I went to vote this morning. I voted on Election Day this morning, and there weren't many voters at my precinct in Northern Virginia. And so I don't know what that says. Listen, we've known, Brian, that this is an uphill battle. We've known it's an uphill battle. But we fought the battle, and we are hearing from the grassroots that they are energized. But it's all going to be about turnout today. Mm-hmm. And that's why, again, we have worked so hard to make sure everybody understands that, one, you have got to get out and vote. And two, no is the right vote. It's not right versus left. It's right versus wrong.
So I want you to hear another. I think he was former governor, Tim Kaine. Cut 34.
Let's talk about the last vote there in Virginia, the presidential vote. Vice President Kamala Harris won by about 5 percentage points. So the state is relatively split with a left lean, but 90% of House members from Virginia being from one party.
90% of Virginians are not Democrats. That's true.
Correct.
But about 100% of Virginians want election results to be respected. We're deeply worried that Donald Trump will try to interfere with the election results this November or in 2028.
Because what is he talking about?
Honestly, Tim Kaine has consistently over the last year demonstrated that the basic values of Virginia no longer are represented by him. I mean, the guy sat in a Senate committee and said that our basic rights of freedom and liberty don't come from God. They come from government. I mean, come on. This is a guy who represents a state where Thomas Jefferson lived and served as governor and served as president. So, you know, what he is trying to say in this is it's okay to disenfranchise millions of Virginians in order to do something that really nobody understands other than it is a clear political power grab. It's gerrymandering to the worst extent. And this is why they can't defend it. I mean, you literally have Don Beyer, Congressman Don Beyer came in and said, no, this is not fair for Virginians, but you should vote yes. I mean, how can anyone who actually presents themselves as a representative of the people possibly say that? And so this is why, again, we have heard from independents, we've heard from Democrats, and of course, we're seeing lots of Republicans, particularly in our rural communities, say we do not want to be disenfranchised. We want our voices heard, and therefore we are going to express ourselves at the polls. Now, again, I said this has been an uphill battle. It's been an uphill battle that we have truly been fighting at the grassroots, and I've been encouraged, but it's going to be all about turnout today.
Right. So you don't fully feel as though if this gets passed, it's going to switch back, right?
No, I mean, listen, there's been one great American, George Washington, who voluntarily gave up power. And for them to say that, oh, this is temporary and we're going to have a 10-1 map in Virginia, which so gerrymanders the state worse than New Jersey, worse than Illinois, worse than California, and then they're going to turn around and give it back. I mean, that is preposterous to think that that's what they'll do. And the bottom line is they violated the Constitution in order to do this. They violated the state statute in order to do this. And now they are demonstrating that they are willing to literally try to deceive voters in Virginia with this whole campaign where they'll never even put a map up. They'll never present the map on TV or describe it or at a rally because it is so ridiculous. So, and that, to me, is the antithesis of everything we believe in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And that's why, again, people have to vote no.
Governor Glenn Youngkin with us. And, Governor, how do you think you would have done had Virginia had this didn't have this bizarre rule you could only serve one term? You think you would have beat Spanberger?
Well, first of all, Brian, I respect the Constitution. And when you are sworn into office, you put your hand on a Bible and you swear to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And while I do believe that governors should have more than one term because it's incredibly inefficient for the state to have turnover every 4 years, at the end of the day, that's the Constitution, and I respect it. And I call on all Democrat leaders to respect the Constitution. They violated it in the way that they engineered this process. listen, we have a case in front of our state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court should have actually opined on this before this election and not put us through this, but they will opine on this. And I firmly believe the case is incredibly strong because what they did was wrong. They did not follow the constitutional process in order to do this. With that said, they're supposed to protect and defend it, and they're not. And the Virginians should raise their voice and once again understand that their vote matters. It really matters.
So, Governor Youngkin, you're going to say the courts are going to have a shot at this, whether it passes or not? I mean, if it passes, the court's going to look at this?
Well, they claim they are. Briefs are due later this week. I'm frustrated that they didn't do this beforehand, but I've consistently said the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Virginia needs to do its job, and it needs to stand up for liberty and freedom and for our Constitution. And what the liberal left did here was unconstitutional. It's clear to me.
Are you going to go to the Washington Correspondents' Dinner?
I'm not planning on going, Brian.
You're not? Okay.
I've got an out of town engagement.
Because I've never seen someone so fired up who's out of office. I mean, you look like you're ready to go. Like you feel like you're just hitting your stride. Did you like politics more than you thought you would?
No, Brian, I love public service. Right. And I've never felt more purposeful in my entire life other than when I found my faith and when my wife said yes. When I asked her to marry me, I will tell you that every morning I got up out of bed with a real sense of purpose of what we needed to do in order to serve the people. Listen, when you're elected into office and people put the trust in you that being elected means, you have to deliver on what you promise. And I firmly believe that we did exactly that. And I think that's why Virginians are so frustrated with the current governor. Abigail Spanberger said she was going to deliver on trying to make Virginia more affordable. And she's driving up electricity bills by putting a carbon tax on everybody. She promised everyone that she's going to make Virginia safer. And the first thing she does is turn Virginia into a sanctuary state. And we have seen so many violent crimes committed by illegal aliens in the last few months. It's absolutely awful. And then finally, listen, the icing on the cake was she said she had no interest in redistricting, and look what she's doing. This is what people hate about politicians who don't tell the truth. And when we were in office, I felt we delivered on everything we promised we were going to do, never felt more purposeful. And that's why it's been so easy for us to slide into this effort to convince Virginians to vote no. I mean, we have traveled around the state. People are responding in an extraordinary way. But again, it was an uphill battle, and today's going to matter, and we've got to get the vote out.
All right, Governor, thanks so much for your time. And we have so many stations in Virginia. I know they appreciate your perspective and your 4 years in office. And we'll see what's happening next. You were the 74th governor from 22 to 26. Governor Glenn Youngkin, thanks.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Ever heard of Warren G? It's an energy someone gives off when they have an American Home Shield warranty. It's the feeling of protected appliances and home systems, covered repairs or replacements, HVACs, ovens, fridges. Wow, my warranty is incredible. American Home Shield. Don't worry, be warranty.
For 20% off our plans, visit ahs.com/listen. See ahs.com/contracts for coverage details, including limit amounts, fees, limitations, and exclusions.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. When we get back, Jamie Metzl will be joining us. But also, we're talking about what's happening in the war in Iran. We know that the vice president's going with his delegation, going to Pakistan now for meetings. And I'm looking at the Tehran Times, which is just a remarkable piece of fiction. But they do say, so far, nobody from Iran is in country, in Islamabad, in Pakistan. So they don't show up. That's essentially saying ceasefire's gone, the war's back on. And there's really no substitute for it. So maybe they need to be convinced on how embarrassed they should be about their horrible display and lack of reaction. And less, of course, sending bombs into buildings in other countries is an offense.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by Fox News congressional correspondent Bill Malusian.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Must listen to podcasts from Fox News Audio. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Now that you've bumped up against the hard realities of a $5.4 billion budget shortfall and the other red tape that you have to go through, do you still believe in democratic socialism? Do you still think it can be effective?
I believe in it even more than I did the day before, and that's because of the fact that it is focused on the needs of working people, and working people need that focus, that fight from politicians more than ever.
So that is the mayor on Meet the Press on Sunday, and he talked about 100 days in, he's more convinced than ever that socialism works. And a couple of days before that, he was in front of Ken Griffin's house, the CEO of Citadel, mocking him, saying that no longer can you stay in an expensive condo as your second home. We're going to tax you more, as if that's a policy that's going to benefit New York City. I'm befuddled by it, but yet Barack Obama chose this weekend to show up and support this mayor. Is he the future of the party? Let's find out if Jamie Metzl thinks so. He's a former NSC and State Department staffer under President Clinton, Senate Foreign Relations staffer under President Biden, and former UN official, author of Super Convergence and a brand new book called The AI 10 Commandments. Jamie Metzl wrote it with GPT-5, and I'll get to that in a second. But on what the mayor said, Jamie, he's more convinced than ever that democratic socialism works. Are you?
I am not. You just have to look at world history to see what happens when we move towards the path of down the path of socialism and communism. I wrote a whole PhD on what happened in Cambodia in the 1970s. Look at Russia, look at China before they jettisoned actual socialism. And so we don't want that. What we want is to have a form of capitalism that's not entirely unfair. And I don't think we need socialism to do that. We just need good governance and accountability, and we need good schools and all of those things that can help all boats rise.
So who in the Democratic Party does give you hope that maybe they get what you just said?
Yeah. I have a lot of hope for parts of the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party decides to veer left to the lunatics like AOC and other extremists like her, I think it's going to be terrible for the party. But we have people like Andy Beshear, like Wes Moore, like Gretchen Whitmer, Josh Shapiro, who are really firmly centrists, who are have a message that I think a lot of Americans could get behind. But the Democratic Party, if we try to have a big tent and we allow bigots and left-wing extremists and globalize the Intifada people into that tent, it's like having skunks show up at your wedding.
Hassan Piker.
Terrible. Democrats should unequivocally condemn Hassan Piker, just like we're calling for the Republicans to condemn Nick Fuentes. It shouldn't be complicated.
Right. And I think for the most part, any Republican that would appear with Nick Fuentes would be eliminated, right?
It should be. I mean, my feeling is...
But Hassan Piker sitting with Ro Khanna.
It's terrible. No, it's terrible.
He wants to be president.
If we had like the KKK show and you say, hey, come be on the KKK show, anybody who would show up to that show, you would say, hey, you're out. You're an extremist. We don't want what you're selling. I think Hassan Piker, Nick Fuentes, and their like on the far left and the far right should be toxic. It's terrible that they're not.
You know, the argument is, for both sides, is, oh, we want everyone included. Just because I disagree with you doesn't mean you can't be a Democrat or a Republican.
Yeah, well, I mean, we want to have a big tent, but as I said before, we don't want a tent that's so big that all kinds of bigots and racists and people who are antithetical to the best values of the United States are in.
Didn't we used to get that? I mean, for example, if you are, I'll give you an example. If you look at the Tea Party, yeah, they were extreme. They were talking about fiscal responsibility. They opposed Barack Obama, but they weren't dangerous. You know, they weren't pro-Nazi. Yeah. You know, they didn't say we deserve 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, so you go, okay, these guys, man, they're really conservative Republicans who are upset by the spending with everything that happened in 2008. Okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. It's debatable. That's go back and forth. But this is scary, I think.
Yeah, I think, on the far left and the far right, I mean, we have the pro-Nazi stuff for Hassan Piker, for Nick Fuentes. We had these private messages by the young Republicans about Nazism. All of it should be condemned. We should say we are Americans. We believe in the set of Enlightenment principles that are the foundation of our country. If you believe in those principles, if you believe in our country and our democracy, we want you in this tent. If you're against them, no.
Congratulations. You have a book out today. It's called The AI 10 Commandments. You wrote it with a co-author.
I did. And this is the first, and people may get scared when I say this, but this is the first major nonfiction book ever written with a human and an AI as the named co-authors. And people imagine that I just, you know, pressed the magic AI button and then I went and went jogging and got a coffee and I came back and, oh, hey, here's the book. But it was a really complicated, layered, iterative, and even creative process of writing this book.
So you want, do you really want the commandments of AI that you hope that we all adopt? Things, do's
well,
and don'ts?
So it's not the commandments of AI. It's the it is the lesson of all of human history. And so I used AI as a partner and as a tool to do an analysis of the entirety of human recorded history, all of our religious, spiritual, moral, and ethical traditions. And based on that analysis, to come up with 10 principles based on all of us that if followed by everybody would lead to the greatest amounts of peace and happiness. So this isn't like some alien intelligence giving us 10 commandments. Right. It's saying, what do we all have in common? And it turns out that as wonderful as our Judeo-Christian 10 commandments are, the people who wrote those or whatever, however they were written, they didn't really know much that there were people where we are now in the Americas who had their own very wonderful, special moral and ethical traditions or people in India. And by looking at all of us, we can see how much we have in common and that we have these universal principles that come from all of our traditions.
What are some of those principles?
Well, here we, it's if you open the book, actually, but they're just very, I'm just going to call them up on my phone. So I can, I want to read them to you in.
And by the way, this is chat. I did not know this. The last version of ChatGPT is GPT-5.
Yes. It, you know, it keeps getting
better. Keep getting better.
Better. Yeah. So here, I'm going to go to.
In real time, it got smarter than us. And
you know, it's getting smarter every day. And but there are some people who are talking about this thing, artificial general intelligence, AGI. And what they mean by that is when computers can do everything better than we humans can do. And what I tell everybody, I summarize my response to that in 7 letters, AGI-IS-BS. Humans, we need to love our intelligence. We represent 4 billion years of embodied intelligence. There are so many things that we humans can do and do every day that our machines will never be able to replicate. And so the name of the game isn't saying that humans are the new Neanderthals, as some people say, or that AGI is coming. It's that we have these incredible machines. And what we need to figure out is what can machines do better than we, and what can we do better than machines, and really index on being great humans. So I can read you now if you want AI. I'll try to read them quickly because I know we don't have unlimited time. Treat every being with compassion and dignity. Do no harm. Actively protect the vulnerable. Speak and act truthfully with integrity and humility. Share generously, especially with those in need. Seek to understand others before judging them. Resolve conflict with fairness, forgiveness, and the intent to heal. Live in harmony with nature and all forms of life. Value wisdom over dominance. Cultivate inner growth. Honor the freedom and uniqueness of others. Remember the sacredness of life. Live with awe, gratitude, and love.
Wow. So that's what you came up with your co-author.
Based on all of our human history, and I think people are so willing to give away our agency because we see this remarkable AI revolution, but the training set of these AI systems is us. It's all of our history.
And we taught AI.
And the data set of AI is us. So we shouldn't look at AI and say, oh my God, AI is so much smarter than we are. AI is reflecting our own intelligence and our wisdom back to us. And so we need to see ourselves in AI.
So what is the process? How did you do it with GPT?
So with the writing the book? This last summer, I gave a talk at the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York on AI and spirituality. And as part of that, I talked about these AI 10 commandments and my idea for how we could come up with them. And people kind of mobbed me after my talk. Go, give me those commandments. So I decided I was going to write a book. And what I did is first I did just the old fashioned way on my computer, did an outline in a detailed outline. And then I went through in little areas where I thought, well, I'd want to have three paragraphs on this specific topic. I put in the prompts in my outline, and then I trained AI on my writing style by uploading all of my stuff. And then I would start writing the book. And when I would get to a point where I'm summarizing, you know, the effect of the printing press on Protestantism or whatever, I would say, here is a thesis statement. Give me 3 paragraphs on this topic, making these 5 points. And it would do something, and I would say, that's not quite right. Make these changes. And I'd keep doing that until it looked okay. Then I would take that text and I would edit it And then I would put it back into GPT-5 and I'd say, how can we make this better? And then we'd have four or five back and forths. And then it would be, all right, this is pretty good. And then I'd plop those three paragraphs into the manuscript and move on. And we did this thousands and thousands of times. And that's why, as I was saying to you before we went on air, when I was finished with the book, I just thought this was a really deep collaboration. It was something new. No previous human authors could ever have done this. And so I need to reflect, if I had only my name on the front of the book, that would just feel fraudulent. Right. And so I wanted to reflect and then describe in detail the process that I used to generate this text.
So, Jamie, tell me, and with Jamie Metzl now, his book is now out today, The AI Ten Commandments, that he wrote with GPT-5. But, Jamie, what do you say to people who are getting worried because of some experiments that happened that shows that artificial intelligence has a survival instinct?
Yeah, we should be. There are a lot of things that people are worried about job displacement. We're seeing autonomous warfare in Ukraine that could grow to other and will grow to other parts
robots
of the world. Yeah, we're seeing we're building agency into these AI systems. So I think it's very healthy for us to be worried about a lot of things. But there's a reason why anxiety has been preserved in evolution. It's not a wasted emotion. It's we fear things that might happen, and then that should inspire us to do the work that's required to optimize potential benefits and minimize potential harms. And that's why, for me, as we enter this ultimately, I think, exciting era of AI, we can't just say there can be no governance and we don't need any regulation. Let's just let it play out. If that happens, we're really going to be in trouble. We need acceleration. We need to create the most exciting ecosystem for these amazing technologies to grow, but we need to have some kind of guardrails.
Right. And do you cover those guardrails?
Yes.
So do you believe that other countries are going to be responsible as Jamie Metzl?
No.
And other companies,
no,
too.
No, it's true, but that was always the case with nuclear power and nuclear weapons, and we have a whole history of saying, what are the ways that we establish the right kinds of frameworks where we are, where we try to build models everywhere? And that doesn't mean that everybody's going to do the same thing, but it also means that governance and regulation aren't just about restricting ourselves. If you have the greatest race car in the world and you just drive around town with your foot only on the gas, it's going to feel great for a while, and then you're going to crash the car and you'll be worse off. So we need to get the right balance between our foot on the gas and our foot on the brakes.
Right. So I think that one thing that's been brought up to me is that for people who fear China worries too, because, for example, those people want some rights.
Yep.
And they want some freedom, and they want access to the internet, and they want maybe some say in their government, and maybe AI will find a way to get them that.
Well, even right now,
and that's why their government might crack down on it.
It's true, but even right now, so Anthropic just released their early model of an algorithm, an AI system called Mythos, that can essentially break all of the computer security systems, because it finds these bugs, some of which have been undetected for decades. And so that is something where we have it, and presumably the Chinese government doesn't. So we are going to be in an escalatory environment. And I think for all of our benefits, we need to decide what are the limits, not because out of some kind of altruism, but to balance our need to defend ourselves, to make sure that America is as safe as possible, to make sure our warfighters have all of the capabilities when they're fighting against adversaries who will be deploying AI aggressively. So all of that is a given. But we need to find the right balance to build the safest future.
Will you split your profits with...
I've already done it, as a matter of fact. I, at the end of writing this book, I said to GPT-5, I said, we've written this book together. By the way, you know from book writing, like, profits are an elusive goal, but that's beside the point. I said to GPT-5, we've done this thing together. I'd like to make a contribution in your name. Will you please tell me where I should make the contribution? And so it gave me these options. I said, well, please pick your favorite. And it picked an organization run by a friend of mine, Fei-Fei Li at Stanford. She has a center for human-centered AI. And so I made a contribution in GPT-5's name to the Center for Human-Centered AI at Stanford. But ironically, they sent me a thank you note. In the little text, I said, this is on behalf of GPT-5. But they sent me the thank you note back.
Because they can't get their head around it.
Exactly.
Over at Stanford. Congratulations. Pick it up. The AI 10 Commandments. Jamie Metzl and GPT-5 have written it. And it's a new moral code for humanity. A lot to bite off. Jamie, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Back in a moment.
In a world of noise, get the signal. Sharp, informative, and always on point. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade.
This week on the Fox True Crime Podcast, psychotherapist and author Lena Dhurhali breaks down the mind of Chris Watts and the warning signs behind one of America's most disturbing family murders.
Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
They probably have done a little bit of restocking. We caught a ship yesterday that had some things on it, which wasn't very nice. A gift from China, perhaps. I don't know. But I was a little surprised, but because I have a very good relationship, and I thought I had an understanding with President Xi, but that's all right. That's the way war goes, right?
Well, that is the President of the United States realizing the ship he pulled over had some material on it that could be used for bombs and military equipment, and it's from China. And when we pulled that ship over, it didn't want to pull over for 6 hours. It resisted, and we shot out the engine room. And then we took the ship, and we still have the ship to this moment. And that's why Iran, time is not on their side. We basically sealed off all their ports. Straight from Hormuz on down. So they're not getting anything in and out. Now, they just claimed they had 23 ships get out. And Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, just applauded them and basically said, great job on Twitter for everyone to see. Do you realize the message it sends? Number one, it just reveals the Democrats really want the country to lose because it makes Trump look bad, or they just hate the country. This guy wants to be president, and he can't think that we want to prevail and understand that you don't like the tactics or the way we got in this one thing, but actually cheer that Iran is breaking an American blockade is something to celebrate. What are you pro-Iran shipping now? Are you pro-releasing all the sanctions? Are you pro for them to sell oil? Makes no sense. But that's how crazy things have gotten. The President of the United States talked a little bit earlier on CNBC. General Jack Keane on where we're at right now. Cut one.
I think what we're witnessing right before our eyes is a power struggle inside of Iran. And yes, Ghalibaf, while he was a general in the IRGC at one point, right along with Vahidi, who is now the head general in the IRGC, Ghalibaf does represent the political side of it, because he's the speaker, head speaker in the parliament. And I think they are really at odds. We have talked to Ghalibaf in the past, and so we know for a fact that he is willing to make some compromises on the deal. In other words, some concessions to the United States. It's likely, we don't know for a fact, but Vahidi disagrees with all of that. And this power struggle is going on, and what will be the resolution of it?
We watched them fight, evidently. They had 70 people at the last meeting in Islamabad, and they were fighting right in front of J.D. Vance, Witkoff, and Jared Kushner, which makes it tough to cut a deal when they can't even deal with each other, don't you think? It'd be interesting to see if anybody shows up in Islamabad now.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
On the world, Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you. A lot going on today. We'll try to keep it up to date. They're trying to get funding right now for DHS. They can't agree in the House and Senate on how to do it. It's just ridiculous that Chuck Schumer's leading this charge, trying to keep his job. Governor Jim Gilmore is standing by, former governor of Virginia. And Neil Chatterley, the chief of government affairs and former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under President Trump. We're going to talk about where those energy costs are going right now. The market is almost over 50,000 on the premise that we're going to have peace talks with Iran. But I don't have much hope of that coming out. And we'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We will proceed in a manner consistent with our approach to these types of ethics matters, which is to always and at all times follow the facts and apply the relevant law without fear or favor.
Yeah, exactly. That means a Democrat who swindled money out of the COVID funding could be going down and thrown out of the House. Ethics deficit, House expulsion aplenty as both sides target the other. And we could be looking at two more forced exits. I'll explain.
Number two.
Even politics should have rules, and those rules should not allow any state to have these midterm redistrictings. It just leads to chaos.
Who can argue with Ari Fleischer? We're talking about today in Virginia. The people decide if they would like to turn the purple state blue when it comes to Congress, redrawing lines that would deliver the House basically for the Democrats. We're going to look at the polls and the final pitches.
Number one.
One of the things no one seems to have thought of in this long shot hope for regime change is that by killing so many people, we have totally disrupted the hierarchy of decision making in Iran. You have more radical people coming to the fore. So what you have is an erratic U.S. side, an Israeli side that's essentially uninterested in peace, and an Iranian side that's more radical and divided. It's not clear who has the authority to make peace.
Richard Haass is not right when I talk about an erratic U.S. side. Less time to talk. American delegation heads to Pakistan right now. If nothing's produced, it's back to the fight as the ceasefire will be over. Joining us now is the 68th governor of Virginia, Jim Gilmore. Governor, great to see you.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for the chance to be with you.
No problem. First off, for basically all of my adult life, Iran's been a problem. Are you glad that we're addressing this problem?
I think that we're addressing a long-term problem. I think that it's clear that Iran, Russia, and China are now joined in trying to upset the world order that's been led by the United States. And I think that we're right to lead the world. We're the ones that have the correct values. We're the ones that stand for democracy and freedom and values and human rights. That's what we do together with our allies. The Chinese and the Russians now are combining up with Iran, and it's a long-term problem, Brian. Now, whether we're in a position right now to win this or to change this is a subject of some discussion.
Right. I believe we're going to find out very shortly. I know we are in a position to go back and fight it. We might have to do some more damage, perhaps. But talk about doing damage. With redistricting in Virginia, instead of a 6-5 split, we're looking at a 10-1 split. What's going on here?
You know, it's very important to me that your listeners and your viewers in Virginia really hear our voices on this. This is a critical moment in Virginia politics and really in American politics. People need to get to the polls today and vote no. There's been a lot of money spent to try to get people fooled into voting yes, but it's very imperative that people in Virginia today go and vote no against this crooked redistricting that's going on. You know, look, there's all kinds of problems with this, Brian. Number one, the argument's been made that this is temporary. In fact, they even put that misleading information on the ballot language. It is not temporary. It is not temporary. It's going to be affect things in 2026. 2028, 2030, and probably 2032. That's a long time in politics, and it's going to solidify the politics of Virginia in a negative way. It poisons the politics. Why would you tell your kids to go vote when everybody knows that the districts are already rigged and there's going to be a particular election, a result? So it's absolutely wrong. They should not be allowed to rig this. And it's very important that the people that are listening to your show get themselves to the polls today and vote no.
And we have a lot of stations in Virginia and a lot of listeners in Virginia. And I think it's pretty important for people to understand what's at stake. I also thought it was interesting that Britt Hume took a look at this. And here's what he had to say. Cut 28.
The one thing this is not an effort to do is to ensure fairness. It is done to ensure that Democrats have many more seats than they do now. Virginia, unlike other states, actually had a system set up to take redistricting out of the hands of the politicians, and it gave it to a bipartisan commission split down the middle between the two parties so that there wouldn't be any of this sort of monkey shines. So Virginia decided that it was forbidden to do so by this commission system they had enacted, that they want to undo it with a state constitutional amendment, which is what people are voting on. But it's very confusing because the message is being sent, say, both sides are saying we're trying to restore fairness. Fairness isn't really what it's all about. It's about power, and the Democrats have some, and I think they're in a position to get more.
I didn't even realize it was nonpartisan when they put together the current districts.
Yeah, and it was. It was nonpartisan. And it's part of the Virginia Constitution now that we're not going to have rigged elections. The Democrats are actually going against that now and have proposed to rig the elections. I've never seen anything like it. And the advertising that they're doing says, well, we have to take it out of the hands of politicians. Brian, this is being caused by the politicians of the Democratic Party who are trying to rig the elections. So they're really, not only is it a bad thing to be doing, it's a dishonest thing that they're doing. The ballot language is crooked. The process is crooked, and it should not be permitted. Now, look, I understand what they're talking about. They want to get at Trump, and I understand that. But it is not worth ruining the democracy in Virginia in order to try to get their hands on Donald Trump. That's not a good trade-off.
Well, here's President Obama. He does not agree with you. Cut 35.
By voting yes, you can push back against the Republicans trying to give themselves an unfair advantage in the midterms. By voting yes, you can take a temporary step to level the playing field.
It's not temporary. Eric Holder said the same thing as temporary. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's not temporary. It's not temporary. It's going to sully congressional elections for at least the next three cycles. And, you know, after a while, these Democrats are going to get in there and they're going to feel like they're permanent. So even if they, in the unlikely event that they redistrict again in a fair way, they're going to try to manipulate them again later on, because these congressional people are already going to be in there. But there's one more point I want to make. If the Republican Party knows that they can't really nominate candidates in Virginia over the next three or four cycles because there's going to be an automatic loss, then that's going to poison not only the process, but it's going to poison the Republican Party. Now, I fought my entire life to make sure that there was a two-party system in Virginia where the people of Virginia had a choice. And then at that point, the Democrats and the Republicans all could offer their platforms. The Democrats are trying to reverse this now and go back to the old Democrat machine of the old days that says there's only one party in Virginia, and that's the Democrat Party. That should not be permitted. We've come too far in the process of two-party systems in Virginia to ruin that with this vote right now. It's not only illegal, it's unfair, and it has a long-term dangerous problem for the democracy in Virginia.
Well, Senator Tim Kaine disagrees. Listen to this exchange on Sunday. Cut 34.
Let's talk about the last vote there in Virginia, the presidential vote. Vice President Kamala Harris won by about 5 percentage points. So the state is relatively split with a left lean, but 90% of House members from Virginia being from one party?
90% of Virginians are not Democrats. That's true.
Correct.
But about 100% of Virginians want election results to be respected. We're deeply worried that Donald Trump will try to interfere with the election results this November or in 2028, because we saw him do it before. And we have to have.
Do you agree with that?
No. Listen, President Obama, that you previously in your previous clip, you know, he came out of the presidency with a pretty good image. He's staining his image. He's going back to being a ward healer again. And as for Senator Kaine, I like him personally, but he knows he's wrong about this. He knows that he is. He knows that he's getting ready to disrupt the democracy and the voting rights of the people of Virginia. The people of Virginia, in the other counties and cities across the state, are going to be dominated by these spindly little weird districts that they've drawn that runs up into Arlington, Alexandria, and Fairfax. That's not democracy. It's not fairness. And it's deliberately crooked. They're telling you that it's crooked. They're telling you we're doing this in order to make a crooked system. The people of Virginia are being invited to be complicit in this, Brian, and they shouldn't be. They ought to reject this crookedness and vote no today.
Governor Jim Gilmore, our guest. Governor, what about the early voting? You know this stuff. In 2025 for the governor's race, the AG, 1.42 had shown up in the early voting. Now 1.37, slightly softer turnout. Does that work to your benefit?
It's actually a very large turnout. And, you know, we don't know what benefit it's going to be. We don't know that. And furthermore, we don't know how people are really voting here. There are going to be plenty of Democrats that are going to be awake to what I've been saying, and they don't want to ruin the democracy for themselves and their children just for some partisan temporary advantage, although I think they're putting themselves in a position where this is going to be a permanent advantage. And I think that a lot of people know that. So we don't know how people are voting, although we do know there's been a big turnout, Brian. bigger than I think expected in an off-year election.
Right, off-year and then off-time. So the off-year election was it's still a little bit behind that, but you're surprised for a referendum. You're still getting people out there. But they put a zillion dollars in. Both sides put a lot of money in. The left put in a lot more than you guys. Is that why you're out here today?
Yeah, because a lot of out-of-state money's come in order to try to rig these elections. And in order to nationalize, if you will, the Virginia vote. But the votes, words kind of getting out there right now. I'm not the only voice out there. There are plenty of Republicans out there explaining how this is going to not just destroy the Republican Party as an institution, but it's going to destroy the democracy itself and integrity. We Virginians are always priding ourselves on integrity. That's what we always have stood for. But this is not integrity. This is crookedness. This is crookedness in crookedness in the language of the ballot. This is crookedness in what their declared intention is. Their declared intention is to make this gerrymander in such a way as to rig the elections. Now, how can you with a straight face go along with something like that? Let the rest of the country decide what they're going to do, either pro or against Donald Trump. We Virginians have a duty to our own citizens here to make sure that we have a honest election system.
Well, what do you say to people who think Republicans started it by pushing to redistrict in Texas?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a legitimate argument, to tell you the truth, and I don't support what they did in Texas or in California in reaction or to any other state trying to rig elections or to change these things around. But my duty is to the state of Virginia. My duty is to the people of Virginia. And the voters that are voting today are the people of Virginia, not any other state. And they're deciding their future and their democracy right now. And to suggest this thing is temporary is a lie. It is a flat-out lie, bald-faced. And they're just assuming that the people of Virginia are going to go along with this. I don't have any idea what's going to happen, Brian, but this is going to be a very serious decision that's being made today, and I sure hope that the Virginians that are listening to me and you right now will get out to the polls today and vote no.
All right, former governor of Virginia, the 68th governor of Virginia, Jim Gilmore, thanks so much. We'll see how it goes. It's going to be close. So the Washington Post poll is 2 points.
I'm there. I'm campaigning, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on your show.
You got it. Thanks so much. Listen, we come back, we'll be able to squeeze in some calls, 1-866-408-7669. Then we're going to talk energy with Neil Chatterley, and then we do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
He's devalued the currency of presidential statement, and all these threats, I don't think, impress the Iranians. What if we hit 13,000, targets or something? So if we hit 500 more, it's almost so what? They've shown that they can take a punch. They've shown their resilience, and many times also, as you all know, he backs away. So I don't think that's helping. And by putting pressure on Iran, it actually makes it slightly more difficult for them to be forthcoming at the negotiating table. A big part of the Iranian approach to negotiations is one of what you might call a dignity. And I've negotiated with them myself several times in the past. One of the reasons they want the vice president there is a sign of respect and of level of the talks. They also, shall we say, have some issues with Messrs. Kushner and Witkoff, given that the last two times they led talks, it was in some ways a cover for the launching of military attacks.
All right, that is the most negative approach for the administration, for an American, that I can remember, and I expect more fairness from him. They were there just to do cover. They're not there to do a cover. They're there to work out a deal after you take out Soleimani and hit them hard the year before. You come out and say, listen, I know you're rebuilding the program. I know you just killed 41,000 of your own people. Knock it off, stop it, and hand over the uranium. When they didn't and bragged that they could make 11 bombs, that led to this. So they're not covering for anything. And to think that the Iranians want dignity? Is there dignity in killing people in cold blood? Is there dignity in killing 603 Americans in Iraq, pretending that the insurgency was organic from the people of Iraq when it was really sponsored by Iran and the Shia population? Dignity rocketing into supplying lethal weapons to Hamas and Hezbollah? They deserve dignity? Please. Here's Newt Gingrich, cut two.
We need, let's have it out. Everybody who thinks you can trust the Iranians, you ought to be with the Democrats. Everybody who thinks 47 years of active warfare against us doesn't count, you ought to be with the Democrats. Everybody who thinks that death to America as a slogan doesn't really mean death to America, you ought to be with the Democrats. But don't kid yourself. You're running the historic risk of allowing an evil, totalitarian, religiously driven regime, which has killed over 40,000 of its own people this year. Over 40,000. You're taking the risk. Do you think it's okay for them to have the weapons to destroy your cities? I think that should be a major national debate this fall.
Yeah, have it. And just make sure it ends the right way. Newt Gingrich puts it all in perspective. And they know that I could pull up countless Democrats, almost everyone of power and significance, talking about the danger of Iran and how they can't get a nuclear weapon. And now you have Senator Chris Murphy cheering the fact that erroneously the Iranian regime put out a statement that they've gotten over 20 ships to go through into the ports by our blockade. And he saluted them. Applauded them. I mean, this is just insane. I mean, the Richard Haas company just made, by the way, China shows how clueless they are. They were talking to Saudi Arabia and they told Saudi Arabia to get the Strait of Hormuz open. What are you talking about? The reason why the Strait of Hormuz is even deterred is because of Iran, who you supply and buy 90% of their oil. And they're really calling up Saudi Arabia, telling them to open up the shipping lanes. It's insane. I mean, it just shows cluelessness. Which I never thought China was clueless, but interesting. The ship we interdicted, dual use weapons for bombs for Iran. And the President of the United States even acknowledged, look, I wrote him a letter, don't alarm him. He said, okay. Obviously, their word means nothing.
Show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, we are back, and joining us now is Neil Chatterley. He's the chief of government affairs at Palmetto and former chairman of the Federal Agency Regulatory Commission under President Trump and former senior advisor to Mitch McConnell. Neil, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Neil, first off, how much has this war with Iran affected energy?
I mean, it's huge. I mean, energy is at the core of this. And, you know, obviously it has direct implications here domestically with the price of the pump. I mean, about 20% of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz. And so, you know, the uncertainty there is having an issue, but it has broader implications beyond just gas prices and the movement of oil. When these sorts of disruptions occur, countries internationally and here domestically in the U.S., people start to rethink, you know, our dependence. And that can range from, you know, oil and gas producers in the U.S. looking to South America, to Africa to find, you know, do further exploration, be less dependent on Middle
East oil. What's wrong with
that? Not at all. That's what I'm saying. That's one of the impacts, I think, you know, in terms of greater electrification, lessening our dependence on the region. All of these things are knock-on effects from the war. And so it's just injected a lot of variables, but politically, the challenge for the administration is going to be the price at the pump that people see on giant billboards every couple hundred yards, and every time they fill up their tanks, they're going to be paying higher prices, and electricity bills continue to be a challenge, and this just further layers on challenges. So longer term, I think there are some very positive things that, from an energy perspective, that could come out from this. In the short term, there's going to be some pain.
I understand that Saudi Arabia has found a way to still sell their 15 million barrels of oil a day and through the Red Sea and through their pipeline. Is that correct?
That's outside of my area of expertise. I'm not a foreign policy expert.
Would you? No, I'm talking about energy. Yes. Yeah. Like, do you think that Saudi Arabia is still able to export the same level?
I can't. I can't.
What about
speak to that.
What about have we seen an increase in people coming to fill up on our shores?
So
Texas.
I mean, you know, there's no question, and I think that's been part of the president's, you know, theory of the case was that this would be a boon to domestic producers. And I think, yeah, a lot of the good work that we have done over the years, whether it comes to natural gas production, enhanced oil production. When I was chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I was quite proud. We approved 12 pretty significant liquefied natural gas export facilities during my tenure. All of that work, a lot of it done during the first Trump administration, has better positioned us domestically. We're a little bit more insulated than, say, Europe or Asia in particular. I think they're feeling a lot more pain than Americans are because of our energy
dominance.
Isn't
it amazing that one little strait can really affect so many countries?
I mean, you're talking about 20% of global supply that's got to go through that little strait. It's wild that we've created, you know, a global infrastructure in which just, you know, this shutdown in the strait is having this kind of knock-on effect.
So what about when it comes to AI? The president had an executive order that if you're going to build an AI data center, you got to build a power plant. How hard is it to build those power plants?
Yeah, it's a challenge, and we're trying to sort through it. The issue is really a speed issue. I believe fundamentally that we are in an AI race against the Chinese Communist Party. I think we need to do a better job at all levels of explaining to the American people what the consequences of allowing an autocracy in the Chinese Communist Party to control AI would mean. And so we need to get power, and we need to get power quickly, but we need to do so in a way that, one, doesn't further drive up electricity bills, but two, and this is, I actually think, much more important, we got to make sure that on the hottest days of summer when Americans need air conditioning, or the coldest days of winter when they need heat, that they've got access to power. And if we don't build new generation and get new generation built fast, I am worried that on that hottest day of summer, if a grid operator has to decide where's that power going, to a 24/7 data center support AI, or to a residential consumer that needs AC, it's going to that data center, and that's when the pitchforks will come out.
Absolutely, and they should, because it's got to be Americans before AI. But a couple of things. Why is it so hard to build a power station?
Part of it is we're behind. Quite frankly, we have had relatively flat demand for electricity for the better part of the last two decades. And now we're seeing a significant spike in demand driven not just by AI and data centers to support AI, but also things like streaming services, crypto and Bitcoin mining, increased vehicle electrification and building electrification, reshoring manufacturing in this country, semiconductor manufacturing. All of this stuff takes a tremendous amount of power, and it all kind of came online, you know, in the last, you know, handful of years. And because of, you know, things like, you know, focusing on policy, you know, around climate and energy transition, coupled with the fact that utilities, quite frankly, haven't invested in building out a grid that can accommodate all this growth, we just fell behind. And some of that is policy related. Some of that is business related around the incentives that utilities have for building out infrastructure. And now we find ourselves in quite a jam.
How many are online or on deck to be built?
Everything's getting pushed. You're already seeing it. So there's proposals out there. Until we get clarity on where this power is going to come from, I think you're going to continue to see some of these projects get delayed and
data
get pushed
centers.
Out. Data centers.
So why don't you build the power stations first?
It's a time to market issue. Like I said, speed matters. And so takes maybe, what, 2, 3, 5 years to build new power centers. So what we're trying to figure out is how can we speed up that process to get new generation built more quickly. But in the meantime, how can we utilize our existing generation more efficiently and find out ways, can we co-locate a data center, say, in the footprint of an existing nuclear plant, tap into that plant's power right away, make the data centers pay the cost so that, you know, grandma and grandpa aren't paying for Google's energy appetite, and find a way to make sure that we maintain reliability. But you're talking about a limited slice of power here, and that's where it gets complicated. So we got to build new generation, but we also have to figure out in the coming months, how do we use what we've got without hurting consumers?
So, but this is the private sector, or are you asking the federal government?
So right now, this is, you know, DOE's really been leading on this. I want to commend, you know, Secretary Wright, the Deputy Secretary of Energy, James Danley, used to be my colleague at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He really knows this stuff, and they have sent a rulemaking to my former agency, to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, laying out the pathway for how to do this. Now we just need FERC to act.
Right. You mean to green light? Who's building it?
So FERC needs to set the rule, set the policy to give the clarity to investors so that the data centers, the utilities can all come together and both build new generation and figure out how to utilize existing generation. But without that regulatory clarity right now, people are reluctant to invest the billions, if not trillions of dollars.
How close is the clarity?
I think FERC announced last week that they hope to have a decision by June, and I think it's really, really critical that they get there.
Rules and regulations, you mean?
They're finalizing a rule that DOE sent to them.
Okay. And then you'll be able to build simultaneously, perhaps, with states that will allow it.
What it will do, this is a simplified way of describing it, but it's effective. The data centers, the tech companies, they will get expedited interconnection, meaning they'll get plugged in faster so they can get power right away. They will be responsible for paying for the costs of all of these system upgrades, which is a little bit of a change in the way electric utilities do business. And then they will be responsible for something called curtailment, that on the hottest days of summer and the coldest days of winter, they're going to have to get power elsewhere, not from the utility. And that creates, you know, opportunities for distributed generation, things like batteries. So it's a pretty smart proposal from DOE. And I hope FERC does the right thing. The devil will be in the details, but they got to get this right.
Right. Quickly.
And quickly.
Yeah. So what states are on top of it? Any?
The big ones, you know, Virginia's been a leader in this, you know, Georgia, Texas, Pennsylvania. So you got a pretty interesting, you know, kind of crossover of Republican states and Democrat states. But this stuff's challenging. Like, I live in Northern Virginia in something called the footprint of an area called Data Center Alley, where, you know, those of us who live in the area, we love it right now because, look, my 13-year-old daughter, if you saw the soccer field that her team trains at, the U.S. women's national team doesn't have as nice a field as my 13-year-old daughter's team, because we're seeing the benefits of all these tax revenues that are coming from these data centers. But down south of Richmond, in the historical area around, like, say, Colonial Williamsburg, people are like, wait a minute, you're going to build a data center down here in this historic area? People are violently opposed to it in the same state.
Neil Chatterjee, thanks so much for getting us up to date on the latest that we got to keep up with, but we'll make sure to have you back.
I appreciate it.
All right, we'll do a simulcast with Varney and Company. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney and Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
At the back end, we'll be able to take some of your calls, so get online, 1-866-408-7669. Got a lot of your emails, especially from yesterday's show. Going to be able to read them shortly, so that'll be good. But right now, we're going to do a simulcast with Stuart Varney when he's up and when he's ready. I also should tell you that Kevin Warsh is being scrutinized right now and having his moment in front of Congress, where he's going to say what he would be like as a Fed director. And we got to get rid of Jerome Powell. And I'm sure they're going to bring up the president, manipulation. Will he stand up to the president when he says lower rates? But let's listen in.
Brian, New Jersey's congressional candidate, Adam Hamway, he's a well-funded Democrat in the state's crowded 12th district race. He wants to dismantle law enforcement, like ICE, dismantle it, DHS, dismantle it. Watch this.
We are spending $1 trillion, you know, on our defense / Department of War / Department of War Crimes now. And what we need to do is spend that in healthcare and spend it in education. We need to abolish ICE. And so not only do we need to, you know, abolish it, but we need to dismantle the DHS completely.
Can you believe it? Oh, come on. They seem to be moving further and further left, Brian.
Look at the left-winger that just got elected in Mikey Sherrill's seat, who became the governor. And yeah. They said that was a Republican seat. And then Mikey Sherrill said, well, I'm going to be a moderate. I'm from West Point. She ended up being governing a lot different or voting a lot differently than she pretended to be. And then we watch a convincing 12-point victory for this left-winger that's to the left of the squad just win in the 11th district. So that's where New Jersey's heading. I mean, that's for this people of New Jersey. It's time to go to a bordering state or go to another state. That's the message. I mean, that's what they're saying in New York. That's what they're telling in New Jersey. Unless you see eye to eye, they want more spending. They don't want to police the fraud. And they do want to allow immigrants to run wild in their state, illegal immigrants. So that's they're telling you what kind of state they want.
I hear it, Brian. I have to live in New Jersey, okay? Yeah. I've got to live with that, you know? I can't move.
Well, look at where we are right now with this mayor from mayor right here in New York City, who is proud, wants to make billionaires illegal, make them part of the past, unless they're donating to his campaign, and go after the rich. And if you have the audacity, Stuart, to get a second home here, we're going to double your taxes. What kind of... This is so backwards for capitalism and America and the American way.
It is. So wrap that up and move on to this. The New York Mets have lost 11 straight games since Mayor Mandani hugged the team's mascot, Mr. and Mrs. Met. You, Brian, I believe, are a lifelong Mets fan.
Yes.
So do you blame Mandani for the losing streak?
Yes, absolutely. You're talking about a team that got off to a decent start, and then he shows up, and it turns out that Mr. Met, who blew off the WABC Sid Rosenberg, literally went up to, and Mr. Met walked away from him. And Mr. Met, the next thing you know, he's hugging the mayor. And the mayor, since that time, the Mets have lost 11 in a row overall, 10 in a row since the hug. How else do you explain it? I mean, do you fire the manager or do you fire Mr. and Mrs. Met? Or do you just make sure this mayor's a one-term mayor? It just brings bad karma to a team that's coming off one of the biggest collapses in history last year. So I'm telling you, I can't prove it, but I think it has all to do with the hug. Plus, Mr. Met has no neck, and we've accepted that.
Just to expand on this hug, I'm not quite sure I understand it. The mascot snubbed, who is it, the owner, Feinberg, from the Mets?
Steve Cohen. Steve Cohen's the owner of the Mets, but Sid Rosenberg is the number one personality in New York City. And he went to say hello to Mr. Met, and he walked away from him, mainly because he believes that Mr. Met, through those eyes and through that mascot, saw that Sid is very anti-mayor. And they have a shortstop who has a wife that worked for the mayor. And people are wondering if there's somewhat of a divide in the Met locker room between conservatives, many of which got traded off the team, and liberals or pro-Mandami, like the shortstop who's on their team. So has politics, along with Mr. and Mrs. Met, helped to take down this once proud franchise?
The things we take seriously. Unbelievable. Brian Kilmeade, thank you very much. We'll see you again real soon.
You got
it. Get on with your radio show.
I know. Thank you. I will get on with the radio show. But I got some of your emails to go through, that many of which came throughout the show. We are pointing to of the President Trump, and we're talking about these wars. By the way, we're following this story that J.D. Vance is in the air right now with his delegation flying to Islamabad. I saw a report in the Tehran Times, which is a piece of fiction, but it does report Iran's point of view, that says that no one is in Islamabad from the Iranian delegation. Brian, point out to people when you say during Trump's campaign, he advocated for no forever wars. Big difference. Because right now when it comes to forever wars, this is another one of them. I don't believe this is a forever war. I think this is going to be a few weeks, maybe a few weeks more. I think we have to ramp it up to get rid of it. But sometimes you have a president that wants to take on a problem. And by the way, this is from Robert, wants to take on a problem that people let fester. For example, since Chavez took over during George Bush's first administration, Venezuela was a problem. President Trump addressed it. Soleimani was creating havoc in Iraq. President Trump addressed it. When you have a situation with Cuba that John F. Kennedy, LBJ, or the Richard Nixon, Obviously, Barack Obama decided to reapproach. Joe Biden didn't. Donald Trump isolated. Now you have a president. You have a president that has now had a meeting on Monday with a delegation, Cuban delegation, and he's addressing the problem. You could say, why is he creating problem in Cuba? Or is he addressing a problem in Cuba? Why did he go in to get Maduro? Did he create a problem in Venezuela, or is he addressing a problem? Does anybody with a clear thought in their head that's picked up one newspaper in the last four decades think that Iran has not been a problem? Nobody. By the way, I'm more than happy to talk about this in Reno, Nevada on the 30th, July 11th in Pensacola, Florida, all streamed on Fox Nation, History, Liberty, and Laughs. And then Uniting the States tour in fall, which I'll be at the Westbury Music Fair, New Jersey, and Red Bank, Clearwater, Florida, as well as Jacksonville and St. Louis. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets, which come with the ticket, comes a book. Right?
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade coming here from Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world. It's just amazing. I see people on Capitol Hill all the time acting a nonpartisan way. You know, just a partisan way, I should say. But when Chris Murphy said what he just said, like this morning, there was a report, and it was erroneous, that Iran says they've gotten 26 ships through full of cargo through the U.S. blockade. Do you know what Senator Chris Murphy wrote? Awesome. Do you believe this? For the world to see on X. I mean, this guy is really hoping for Iran to win. Not only is it the worst thing, one of the worst things you could do as a lawmaker, during a time of war, even though there's a ceasefire now, rooting for the other side, but you didn't even check to see if the report is true, but you don't care. You would love the idea of cargo getting through. Why? So they can illegally beat sanctions as well as a blockade and export oil, make some money, buy some more weapons, fortify their nuclear program. What is the big picture here? Let's bring in Karl Rove, former deputy chief of staff and senior advisor to President George W. Bush, and we know Wall Street Journal columnist. Karl, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Karl, you used to partisan things when it happened with Iraq, but it took a while for you see Democrats to really kind of campaign and Harry Reid to say irresponsible things, which were wrong.
Yeah.
Everybody knows
the war is lost.
What about this?
Well, I can't remember anything that was as irresponsible as this. Yes, they were against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they made their noise. You know, they made their noises about it. But I don't remember any of them saying, as Murphy did, you know, awesome, glad the bad guys got away with something. I mean, this really is astonishing. And think about it: if it were true, it would be a big advantage to the Iranians because it would allow them to get paid for oil from their country that they could use for the either reconstruction and the, you know, providing the food and sustenance to their people, or more likely to pay for more bombs and missiles to attack America and its allies in the region.
So I want you to hear what Tim Walz is in Barcelona, why they want him to speak. I don't know. Maybe they don't understand how he's represented here, along with Murphy. Listen to this.
We've got a feeble-minded, trigger-happy president who plunged us into a war where no threat was present, with no clear objectives and no exit plan. We need to call that what it is. That's fascism. Or at least it's fascist curious.
I want to bring you greetings as well from a nation that is in crisis. I'm not going to sugarcoat the gravity of what we face right now in the United States. This is the most significant threat to American democracy since the Civil War. Donald Trump in our country is trying to end our democracy.
Can you believe these is saying from Tim Walz overseas in Barcelona saying that, Karl?
When he started off talking about a feeble-minded president, I was wondering for a second, was he talking about Biden?
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought for a second.
Yeah. No, look, this is reprehensible. Okay, you can have disagreements with the president of the United States, but to go abroad and say, like Tim Walz did, that this is fascism. I mean, you know, they use this word Nazi and fascism, and it gets overused. Yeah, really? Was it fascist when the Supreme Court slapped the president down on tariffs? Is it fascism when judges throw out cases that his administration has filed against political enemies? Please don't overdo it. I know you want to have some applause abroad. There isn't much applause going on in the state of Minnesota because of your terrible job in making certain that the taxpayers' dollars were not stolen by a group of thieves. And Mr. Murphy, really, this is the most significant threat since the Civil War? Really? Oh, my God. I mean, you know, it's embarrassing for our country that we have leaders like this who think they can go abroad and talk this garbage and somehow are serving a greater cause.
But the other thing is, who on their right mind doesn't think Iran is a daily threat on a daily basis? I mean, Iran has been a consistent threat. Over the weekend, I had George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, all talking, and Joe Biden, all talking about the danger of Iran. So, that's one thing we used to agree on. How we handle it is where we used to diverge.
Add Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush to that, and add the leadership of the Democratic Party writ large. I mean, you know, remember Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking about the threat that was represented by Iran? Yeah, look, I know we're at a point of intense partisanship, and I know there are people in the Democratic Party who hate Donald Trump, but please, can you love America more for just a few minutes and temper your comments and keep focused on, look, you may have a disagreement with the president on how he's acting towards Iran, but do you fundamentally believe that Iran is a country whose leadership is worthy of respect and dignity by the United States and who really have the best interests of their people and the region at heart? Or do you believe them when they say death to America as they have chanted for 47 years? Come on.
So I want you to hear a lot of the people lining up to run for president. Nobody understands that better than Senator Cory Booker, who went to Michigan, you know, because like every New Jersey senator, you need to go to Michigan because they're having their convention. Listen to some of this rhetoric. Cut 36.
Ladies and gentlemen, there is a storm in our nation. There is darkness and wind. People are getting hurt. What we need is not from on high. We need foot soldiers of our democracy who in times of trial are willing to stand up. Will you stand for our democracy? Will you stand to get out the vote? Will you stand for our children? Will you stand up for our elders? And will you stand
Where did that come from?
Well, you know what? I hate to say this, but at least he had a positive message. Stand up for America, you know, stand up for the elderly, stand up for blah, blah, blah. There's a contrast between that and trashing our country by saying we're on the edge of fascism, as Walls did, or that we're facing the greatest threat to democracy since the rebellion of the southern states, which I remind you were led by Democrats in 1860 and 1861. I mean, you know, at least the guy was trying to appeal to people by pointing them in a positive direction. I can't say the same for Walls and Murphy, who seem to be more interested in sympathizing with our enemies than in rallying their party.
He believes that Donald Trump's a threat to democracy. So we know what's going on in Virginia today. They're going to redistrict, and if it passes, it's going to be 10-1 in terms of Democrats to Republican states. Right now, it's 6-5. Listen to Tim Kaine when asked by Shannon Bream this. Cut 37.
Let's talk about the last vote there in Virginia, the presidential vote. Vice President Kamala Harris won by about 5 percentage points. So the state is relatively split with a left lean, but 90% of House members from Virginia being from one party.
90% of Virginians are not Democrats. That's true.
Correct.
But about 100% of Virginians want election results to be respected. We're deeply worried that Donald Trump will try to interfere with the election results this November or in 2028 because we saw him do it before. And we have to have a Congress that will stand up to it. In 2021, all five Republicans in Virginia went along with Donald Trump in his effort to overturn election results. And so we're giving Virginians a chance to vote, which Republican states have not done, about whether they want to have a congressional delegation that will stand up against Donald Trump's tyranny if he tries to interfere with our elections.
So was there an election in between what he's talking about? What do you think Senator Tim Kaine is doing? What's right?
You know, it's pathetic to see people who, you know, sort of, oh, yes, it is wrong to gerrymander, but let's gerrymander really, really hard. Let's, you know, really, you know, the Republicans did it in Texas. Therefore, we have to do it in California and Virginia as well. I mean, really, please. I mean, this is the people of the Commonwealth. I sort of cut my teeth as a young political operative working in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I was the deputy director of the Republican Party of Virginia back when there weren't a lot of Republicans there. And for Tim Kaine to say that somehow or another that this is a reasonable thing to do is ridiculous. You know, this is pure power. And what they're going to do is if this passes, what they're going to do is disenfranchise a lot of people in Virginia, and people are going to get angry in the Commonwealth because this is just not fair. What they're going to do is take these districts, run little tendrils up to northern Virginia so they can grab a bunch of liberal Democrats in the Washington suburbs, and then drag the district hundreds of miles south and west in order to cut off the chance for Republicans to have anything more than one member. And that one member is going to be from the far southwestern part of the state because there are no Democrats down there anyway to begin with. So, no, look, Tim Kaine, please be honest. This is all about power. And the next time you talk about democracy, do not be lecturing us about the need for democracy when you've done a very undemocratic thing, which is disenfranchised the 44%, 45%, or 46% of the people in Virginia who consistently vote Republican. Now, you know, admit it. It's power. You want to grab power. And this whole phony thing about, oh, Donald Trump is going to steal the 2028 presidential election. Come on, please. I didn't hear Tim Kaine, who was governor of Virginia and running for governor in 2005, criticize the Democrats who stood up on the floor of the House of Representatives and said that George W. Bush stole the election of 2004 by using computers in Germany to switch 122,000 votes in Ohio from John Kerry to his column and thereby won the election. I don't remember Tim Kaine standing up and saying to Democrats, stop making these ridiculous claims. No. Instead, he's going to use this threat of Donald Trump trying to do something in 2028 to justify a undemocratic maneuver, which is to squash the votes of Republicans outside of Richmond, Virginia, and the greater Northern Virginia region, and make it impossible for Republicans to be competitive. Don't just admit it. You're up for power. Admit it.
Hey, Carl, I'm going to throw a few Senate races at you. Tell me what you think they are. First off, with Susan Collins in Plantner, or whether it's the governor, where do you think that is right now?
I think the Democrats are going to be badly split. And if I was a betting person, I'd bet on Susan Collins. She is an independent-minded Mainer, and I think there are going to be a lot of people who say, we can't go for the left-wing lunatic.
What about Watley and Cooper in North Carolina? You see that flipping?
Going to be a tough race. It's a Republican-held seat. Tom Tillis is retiring. Cooper was elected twice as attorney general and twice as governor. The smart thing is Whatley recognizes that in January, for the first time in the history of North Carolina, the number of registered Republicans outnumbered the number of registered Democrats. And shortly after that happened, I happened to be talking to Michael, and I said, congratulations. There are now more Republicans in North Carolina than Democrats. And he said, well, that's right, but there are more independents than either Republicans or Democrats. And in order to get elected, I got to win the independents. And I thought that was a very smart observation. And as long as he governs, as long as he campaigns that way, I think he's got a good shot at winning. But let's not be taking that one for granted, because Cooper has won statewide four times and has a lot more money than Whatley does.
Real quick on John Sununu, do you give him a shot? They thought Chris would have won it. Do you think John Sununu, coming out of retirement, can win the Senate seat?
Yeah, and all full disclosure, I've maxed out to his campaign.
Okay.
I think the world of John Sununu, and more importantly, I think the world of the Sununu family. His father and his brother and he have served their state admirably. And I think the people in New Hampshire say this is a crusty New Englander who's going to do what he thinks is right for our state. And he's going to benefit from the fact that his father and his brother helped establish that, as did he when he served first in the House and then in the Senate previously.
I'll take that a yes. Carl Rove, thanks so much. I think I wore you out now. I should pay you double.
Wore me out. I'm ready to go a couple more rounds with you, man.
You know what? But the problem is Dana Perino's here. She really wants to spar with me.
I'm giving way. to my former White House colleague and special friend.
Right.
Good luck to you and Dana.
I know you guys like to do haikus together. Thanks so much, Carl Rove.
Exactly.
I know. 575. Back in a moment.
Strong opinions backed by hard facts. Get the truth behind the spin with Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. And guess who's in studio? Dana Perino. If you're watching the stream, you're seeing her from America's Newsroom, fresh off that show, 2 hours long. Took some a little bit of time. She jumped into our show in between co-hosting The Five because she wants to see me in person. And she's got a brand new book out today. It's fiction, but it's a lot of it's based on what we're all experiencing. It's called Purple State. And Dana, you are, and people are just listening in their cars, you're wearing purple.
I know, and you know what's interesting is that I actually don't really like to wear the color purple. I would never buy it on my own. But you know, here at Fox, because we have different clothes we need to wear every day, I have this beautiful blazer from the wardrobe department. And I thought if there was ever a day to wear the purple jacket, it was today.
Right. This is not a coincidence.
Right.
So
is planned.
This is a shorter segment because Karl Rove likes to talk.
Does he really? What was that video of his too? Like, I need to talk to him about it. Like, his face was so close to the camera.
Yeah, why was that? He was pretty close to the camera, Allison, right? But he looked good. It was good.
I mean, Carl's amazing. He doesn't age. You know, I've known him for 20 something years. Like, it's weird.
Maybe it's a Swedish thing. Aren't you Swedish?
Oh, could be a Swedish thing.
Aren't you Swedish?
Am I Swedish? Do I look Swedish?
A little bit.
I'm Italian. My last name is Perino.
But is it all? Are you all Italian?
No, I'm not all Italian. Actually, when they did 23andMe on The Five years and years ago, and they surprised everyone, I was only 2% Italian, and I freaked out because I've been like given awards from the National Italian American Society, and I can trace my great 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 grandparents back to Italy. Even before it was Italy, right, in that area. But it was northern Italy, so it was a little Swiss situation.
Well, I just want to tell you, they did take back O.J.'s Heisman because he killed somebody. I don't know if this amounts to the same thing. Would they take away your Italian award?
I don't know. I hope not, because maybe they'll just consider it honorary. I was kind of mortified, though, during the show when we announced it, because we didn't know. We opened the envelopes as a surprise. And I remember also I was 1% Albanian. But I, as Gutfeld looked at me and he goes, "Wow, you are so white."
Well, that's true. I would.
Jesse was 0.1% sub-Saharan African.
And that's why he got into an Ivy League school. So a couple of things. Number one, the bad news is for you when you take that test, your DNA is now on file.
Worry about that, but yeah, I understand some people do.
Now people kind of like worry about that. But tell me a purple state real quick for people that have to leave before we get a chance to really expand on
it. Great. So it's my first work of fiction. If you liked Everything Will Be Okay, which was the mentoring book I did for young women going through their quarter life crisis, this is the fictionalized version of that. I write about three young women from Manhattan. They're going through relationship and career conundrums, and one of them gets an opportunity to work in politics and goes to Wisconsin, convinces her girlfriends to go with her to work on the election for the Democrats, and they are determined they're going to return to New York, but along the way, some romance gets going.
Really?
Yes.
In Wisconsin, and does it stay in Wisconsin? Do they? And well, you can't give it away.
I can't give it away. I mean, they go through. They have to make choices, and I feel in some ways when people read it, they're like, wow, it reminded me of what it was like to date in my 20s. Or for like mothers and daughters who are reading the book are like, oh my gosh, my daughter is going through this. But also I love Wisconsin. It is the ultimate purple state. It goes back and forth and back and forth. But everyone I've ever met from there, I love. And I write about a town that is fictional. I call it Cedar Falls in the book, but in real life, it's modeled after Cedarburg, Wisconsin, a beautiful, fantastic, wonderful place to live.
So that is the table's been set for you to pick up the Purple State, Dana Perino's latest book. It's fiction, but it's based on all her knowledge of politics and romance, two areas in which she's an expert in. And she's going to talk about that a little bit more when we come back. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, Dana Perino's here, America's Newsroom, co-author of The Five, and co-anchor of The Five, and now author of a brand new book called The Purple State, already a multi-best-selling author. this is a new chance, because this is fiction.
Yeah.
But based on everything you know.
Well, I've always, you know, it's funny. I found in my keepsake trunk the first book I ever wrote in the first grade. And it was called If I Were. And I had all these things like if I were a cat, if I were a pig, if I were a dog, if I was a horse, if I was a hippo. And I did illustrations and wrote these stories. And I think kids, especially ones that like to read, you have an early aspiration to be an author. And I never really let that go. And yes, I've written nonfiction, but this was a real departure from that. It was so different. It was such a professional challenge, a solitary endeavor. And the truth is, honestly, I'm smiling ear to ear. I loved writing it. I loved it. I couldn't believe how fast the time would go on Saturdays and Sundays when I sat down from 11 to 4. Those are the hours I dedicated to write. And then I'd come down and I'd give Peter what I'd written. And he read every draft. I probably redrafted 5 times total. I had a great editor. And I love these characters so much. I think about them all the time. I wish they were real.
Right.
And I'm excited to see what they do next.
But is it based on a lot? Like, if people don't know, you do stuff for young...
Like mentoring.
A lot of mentoring here for young people. They first break in. A lot of times their first job. And your door's always open to them. So a lot of... Is it a lot of these stories? Because you recognize something consistent?
So John Glenn is one of our colleagues here. And he read it a few months ago. And he said, is this about one of the girls here at Fox? And I said, it's about all the girls here at Fox, because it really starts with these 3 young women who are going through a quarter life crisis, and they live in Manhattan and they love New York and they're always going to stay here. They met at NYU and they go through what many young women go through. Your daughters are a little young for this, but they will get there. The quarter life crisis is when you start to realize, wow, everything I planned is not working out. Because girls do this, right? They're like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to have this career. I'm going to get this promotion. And then I'm going to meet this guy. And then I'm going to get married. And I'm going to have 2 children by the time I'm this. And you start to realize at 25, 26, like, whoa, none of that's going to happen. And you have this little bit of a crisis. Did I choose the wrong career? Should I leave? Am I living in the right place? And the main character, Dot Clark, she gets an opportunity to go and work for a super PAC in Wisconsin. That's the ultimate purple state. Mm-hmm. Goes back and forth, Republican, Democrat. She wants to help the Democrats. So she convinces her 2 girlfriends to go with her, and they plop down in Wisconsin, northwest of Milwaukee, in the middle of January. And they've got 1 year to try to work on this election. And then some romance ensues. And these are not your typical guys that you're meeting in New York.
So when you have to write about romance, do you look at, like, do you read different magazines for this?
Magazines, I read a lot of fiction. A ton of fiction. So I'll read like a...
You do read fiction. That's amazing. Because you're in a fact-driven world.
Right. And so I read a lot of articles and I listen to a lot of nonfiction podcast. If I'm going to read a nonfiction book, I often listen to it. I actually hard copy read the George Washington one, but listened to Sam Houston of yours.
Yes.
Oh, right. Thanks. I like to listen to nonfiction, but I just adore fiction. So I'll read like a historical fiction, then a deep literary fiction, and then like a romantic comedy. And then I'll cycle through different types, mystery, maybe a crime novel, things like that. And then I would admire the craft so much, and I never thought I could do this. I truly never thought I could do this, because I have never taken a creative writing class, but I've read so many books over the years, and I would say I'm a very good reader. Remember, like, even when you're going on vacation, I'll recommend a book for you for wherever you're going, whatever kind of book you're interested in. So another author that I'm friends with, Andrew Graff, we were going on a walk one day after a book signing that he did for me at a Little Point bookshop. And he said, you said you have an idea for a novel. I said, oh, I'm sure everybody says that. I don't want to bother you. And he said, well, how long is this walk? I said, 3 miles. He said, start talking. And about 200 yards down the street, he said, wait, it could all come down to this one gerrymandered district in Wisconsin. And then I started the next weekend writing it. It came up with all the characters. So I have never written romance, obviously. Jesse Waters asked me if there was sex in the book. I said, well, there's allusions to sex in the book. And he was very disappointed.
Right.
But I ended up at in the categories leading up to the book release, I was number 1 in clean and wholesome romance.
I did not know there was a category, but it is fitting.
Clean and wholesome romance.
Yes. Wow. That is fantastic. I'm sure it's going to be number 1 overall. So when you put this book together, do you put a list of characters? Like, I know of George Washington's Secret Six, they go, this is going to get confusing to people. Put a page of who everyone is so you can keep flipping back.
Yes. And you have to, I made some little character sketches. So, for example, some of the non-main characters are Gene and Ted Jankowski, and they own Reader Falls Bookshop in this fictional town. And so I would make sure I remembered, like, what color hair did she have? How did she dress? She was from England. She has an accent. And I think about Danny Dawson. He's the main love interest. Or Hot Cop Jake, we call him. And his twin brother, Tommy. There's also, I think this is actually very relevant to today, in addition to cross-party possible romance. There's a family farm involved. And there's a foreign entity that wants to buy up the farmland because they want to put, not an AI data center, that wasn't what I was thinking, but like a foreign-owned high-tech factory. And they're trying to buy up the land, but the farmer doesn't want to sell. And so that's also a part of the story that I try to work out.
Which is also real because China's also trying to buy up all this.
That's exactly right. And it's also something that I know. I grew up in Wyoming and Colorado. I love the family farm. I know they want to keep their way of life. I also love New York. I love the young women that I work with. And I love people like my cousins who live in Wyoming and they're ranchers and they're amazing guys. And I just feel like Americans are much more neighborly and get along a lot more than they think they do because of the idea of polarization.
Right. But don't you think polarization really didn't really exist like it did now during the Bush years when you were in the White House?
I mean, at the time it felt like, wow, how can you call President Bush Hitler? But now it's just so routine. And I do think social media has made things much, much worse in the perception and of polarization and also the things that anonymous trolls will say online.
So I understand you're signing books today at Barnes & Noble.
Yes, on Fifth Avenue, believe it or not. My Wyoming self can hardly believe that.
Well, so you're going to be on Fifth Avenue right here, mm-hmm. 5th and 50th? Or is it
maybe
fifth
it's
and,
like 48, like, yeah, 47?
I just walked by there. It's great. Yeah. That's a great store. It's multiple floors.
Yes.
So go down and see Dana today, especially WABC listeners.
I love that. Hi, right? WABC.
Yes. And also May 4th, WABC Big on Long Island, you're going to be with another, is it the Teddy Bookshop? The Teddy Bookshop store?
Can't remember.
It's
Steve Israel owns
Oyster
it.
Bay?
Yes, it's up in that area, the most beautiful area.
Right.
And I love that he left Congress and got a bookstore.
Right. A Democrat that was Nancy Pelosi kind of thought that he'd be the next speaker.
Right.
And he just said, no, I'm out.
I know. I'm very excited to go up there. And especially because for the Democrats who have read the book, they loved it. And I do write it from their point of view in a way that is fun and honest and I think very respectful and hopeful.
It's somewhat bipartisan.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, definitely bipartisan.
Yeah.
So I want you to hear something that's not bipartisan. Are you ready?
Yeah.
You were press secretary during almost the whole Iraq war, weren't you?
Yes.
So we know that there were in the beginning 70 votes in the Senate, everyone's on board, and then it started to switch.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me if you ever heard something like this in Barcelona.
This is
the governor of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. We've got a feeble-minded, trigger-happy president who plunged us into a war where no threat was present, with no clear objectives and no exit plan. We need to call that what it is. That's fascism. Or at least it's fascist curious.
I want to bring you greetings as well from a nation that is in crisis. I'm not going to sugarcoat the gravity of what we face right now in the United States. This is the most significant threat to American democracy since the Civil War. Donald Trump in our country is trying to end our democracy.
It's so shockingly shameful and it's one of those things where, let's say that my sister and I were fighting and we had a big argument, but if someone came in and said something bad about my sister, I would defend her to the hilt, right? And that's how I feel like we should be in America as a family. We can argue here, but I would never go overseas and denigrate America. Now, I'm sure that they would say, look at what President Trump says about us. I don't care. I would never say that about America. And this was a big socialist conference. That was not about American ideals. Do they think that people in the room are supporting American ideals in that room? Right. No, they are socialists.
Why would you go?
Was a socialist conference.
Why would you go to that room?
I would never go.
Right. So to me, I remember like Senator Lugar and some other Republicans that are respected were saying, listen, the war, We got to find a way to get out of this before the surge.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember Harry Reid saying, everybody knows the war is lost?
Yes.
I mean, that was devastating, but it didn't happen in Barcelona.
Right.
You know, it didn't happen in Iraq.
No, it happened on the floor, the floor of the House and the Senate. It also happened behind closed doors. I will also tell you this. Senator McConnell and John Boehner, the congressman, the speaker, they were in charge. They ran the schedule. The Democrats forced, I think it was 27 votes to try to strip money from the troops, and they did not succeed on any of them. They kept, right. But they kept trying. But when troops are in harm's way, you have to make sure they have everything that they need. I don't think anyone takes Walls and Chris Murphy that seriously, but I do think it's shameful. And I think that the Democratic Party, as they go into 2028, really has to think about what kind of party do they want to be, and can they withstand the pull to the left?
Right.
And I don't know if they can.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, Jamie Metzl was just here. He worked for two Democratic administrations. And then we had Julian Epstein comes on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they're not buying into what Mamdani's selling.
Nope.
They're not buying into what Bernie Sanders selling. But I was shocked that I know everyone laughs at me when I say this. I was shocked that President Obama is, because he pushed Hillary. He said Biden was more acceptable than the Bernie Sanders surrogates. And then he pushed her out, pushed him out when he had to. And then he says, I could go to Bashir. I could go to Shapiro. Wes Moore could use a boost. Gavin Newsom could use some coaching. He's got a book out, might need some little juice. But he chose to go read a children's book in New York City with the mayor. And you're not surprised.
I can understand why Obama would want to do it, right? Because I think part of him feels like he should have more fully embraced his socialism tendencies, right, in terms of Obamacare. He wanted Medicare for all, but it's what he really wanted. He wanted the whole enchilada. But because of his advisors telling him, like, we could maybe try this and that, maybe just cut it back a little bit, and that way it will pass the Congress, he said, okay. But I think he looks at Mamdani and thinks, wow, I could have been more like that. Mamdani is the new shiny penny. He's also saying he's not running for president in 2028. So I can imagine that Obama's like, if I'm going to put any of my political energy anywhere, it might be with Mamdani. What I think is even more interesting is who Mamdani asked to be with him. Mamdani's not asking for Kamala Harris or Newsom or Shapiro or Bashir. He asks Obama to come, and that is telling to me, because he thinks that the party doesn't have a good option in 2028. They always want to go back to the well, and they want to go back to Obama.
Yeah, it's, I did not know he asked for President Obama to go, because I know President Obama offered his services. I didn't know if that...
Yeah, why don't you come with me, and we'll talk about free busing and kids. Now, honestly, the clip's kind of cute.
Of them, right? Together, yeah.
And Obama, he's great on TV, he's great on camera, he's good in a crowd. I can understand why Mamdani would want it too, but they're kindred spirits.
So before we go, in reading this book in the summary before you get an introduction, it seems like a movie. It seems to me like a built for a movie. Do you get that? Did you have that in your mind?
Well, when I didn't know what I was doing at the beginning, I can't remember who it was. It might have been Paul Morrow, who, of course, is our Fox News contributor. What people might not know about him is that he's also a great fiction editor. He used to teach Hemingway as a professor.
Molly Hemingway.
No, Ernest Hemingway. He's brilliant. He knows all about literature. And I think it was...
Oh, I thought you meant Hemingway himself.
No, he used to teach Hemingway as a topic.
Okay.
Sorry. Not Molly.
Wow.
I'm like, Ernest Hemingway. No, Paul Morrow. He said, write scenes and then stitch it together. Wow. So sometimes in my mind's eye, like, there's a scene where Tommy and Harper go fishing, and it's her first time ever fishing. And I just imagine what it's like as a city girl. All of a sudden, you're asked to put one of these night crawlers on a hook. And the scene, and I could envision it. And what I'm very proud about in the book is the dialogue is great. It reads super fast. But also, there's an audiobook that goes with it. A wonderful actress read it. I have to say...
Didn't do it?
No, because I think... If you have a fiction book, it should be done by somebody like an actress, like a narrator.
Right.
If you nonfiction, it should be your voice. So no, I didn't do it.
Interesting.
I felt like that would be like self-publishing. But you have to speed up the audiobook a little bit, because the clip I listen to, I understand the pacing.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm like, oh, no.
Well, you know,
she talks a little faster than that.
They've told me you can adjust that on your speed on the listen. So
I do.
Yeah.
I'm at 1.5.
So listen, go see Dana today. What time?
Barnes & Noble. I'm going to head over around 2.
2 p.m. in New York City on 5th Avenue. Around 46th, 47th,
I think, if I remember. Yeah, and 50th at the Barnes & Noble.
It's really cool. By the way, great store. It's got a multiple floors, very nice people. And then on May 4th, if you're in the area, you're going to be on Long Island in Oyster Bay.
Yes.
So that's going to be great. Is there any other events you have? Because we might be heard in those areas.
In New Jersey, I'm going to be at Books and Greetings on this Sunday from 12 to 2. You've been at Books and Greetings?
Yes.
Yes, I'll be there. And at Point Pleasant Beach High School through the Little Point Bookshop, another place you've been, on May 2nd.
Dana Perino Books.
DanaPerinoBooks.com.
Fantastic. Dana, congratulations.
Thanks. We'll I hope you love it.
Absolutely.
I want to get your take on it after you read it.
I absolutely will. And I brought a copy home over the weekend for my daughters. Unfortunately, they were not home. So they're going to be back this weekend. But listen, New York City, do not let Dana down. I want everyone to go and check it out. You heard me. Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we're back, everybody. Brian Kilmeade Show just finishing up this hour. And again, make sure you don't leave Dana alone on Fifth Avenue in Barnes & Noble if you're in the region, if you hear it all. We're following everything. I mean, next time we're on the show, we're going to find out if there's actually going to be a meeting or an end to the ceasefire. We're back at war when it comes to Iran. We're also finding out next time we're together is going to be the verdict in Virginia about redistricting. Listen, Republicans have not won almost anything. Obviously, didn't pull off any upsets since Donald Trump won. So this would be one. It would be a total comeback. They were outspent almost 3-1 in Virginia to not redistrict. And it's going to really hurt their chances of holding on to the House. So also after this, the courts are going to get involved. So that's pretty clear. Quick message. I'm going to be the United States is now out. You could pre-order it. It's going to be really for America 250. So we'll have a chance to talk about that on tour. First, it's going to be November 30th in Reno. And then I'm going to be July 11th in Pensacola. And then we've got a series of events from Westbury, New York to Jacksonville, over to Clearwater, Red Bank, New Jersey. And we have other stops. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com. Get tickets so I can meet you in person.